Yeah, so it's great to have the opportunity to speak here. So I may say that I've spent here now almost 6 months here, and it's now my last week.
Wow.
And so I had a great time here, and also productive time. And today I'd like to talk a bit about issues which to some part have been mentioned before, and that's in the first part of the talk, I want to describe a little bit what the state of the art is of using cold atoms to simulate solid state problems, most importantly the fermionic Hubbard model. But then I'll switch a little bit gears and show that with the cold atom systems, we can also access physics of the Hubbard model, which you can never access in solid state materials, but which has also fun aspects. For example, you can stabilize an exotic metastable sort of superconductivity, which has been there all the time in the Hubbard model, and many of you know this under the name eta pairing, but which can now just easily realized with cold atom systems. Not has been realized, but can be realized soon. So, if you had a quantum computer, then many years ago, Feynman said one of the most realized that one of the most useful things this piece one can use for is really to use the quantum computer to simulate other quantum systems. Yeah? So in the context of our conference, for example, we write a Hubbard model program, which gives you at the output the superconductivity. But as you know, we don't have a universal quantum computer, so and we have to wait quite a bit for this, I'm sure. So you can ask, can we follow a more modest goal that really using one quantum system, yeah, for example, our favorite high RTC superconductors, to simulate another quantum system. And one has to say a one-to-one simulation would be kind of useless. So if the two systems are identical, why should you use one system for the other? It only makes sense if one of the two systems is simpler. So you can forget about disorder phonons, for example, or when you can control it in a better way, so like varying parameters and seeing whether TC increases. Or whether you can probe it with other experimental probes. And one point I want to emphasize also, you can use, maybe it's also a way to use this to test theories. Yeah? So we have theories around, and maybe you can use these other systems to test the theories and then apply it back to the problem to the real materials problems. And finally, I guess we all agree that the real fun is having a different system is also to explore new physics. So that's the last 2 points is kind of what the talk is about. So here comes the Hubbard model, and the main reason I'm showing this is because the hopping is now called J, because this is a cold atoms talk. And
so we have to say how many units of J do you do in T actually?
Yeah, and
it would be JJ model, yeah.
And for some reason cold atoms people call TJ. So there are different theories for that. So the official theory is, I think, is that time is so important, so the letter T, because it's so time dependent, so letter T should be used for something else. There are other theories, like, you know, the first paper using this was written by Jaksch, so I don't know if this is of any relevance.
And what year?
That's 98.
You know, this even before Hubbard, people used B.
Okay, anyway. Okay, so we know that this model has many interesting physics, but maybe the most prominent one is that it features a mod transition. So when you have one electron per unit cell and you have very strong interactions, then you have a mod insulator, while when kinetic energy dominates, you have a metal. Now, there are many experimental examples of systems which feature mod transition, so where you really can tune from the metallic to the insulating side. So one example is V2O3, and the other signature of the mod transition is, for example, first order transition, which can be tuned as a function of pressure and doping. Now, while the Hubbard model is used to think about the problem and also to even to predict experiments for this problem, I think one should realize that this system is really not described by the Hubbard model. So first of all, there are complications like orbitals, crystal fields, disorder, phonons, blah, blah, blah. That's one aspect, but I think the more important aspect is that finally electrons have long-range interactions, and especially close to a mod transition, where there's at least a breakdown of low energy screening, not a complete breakdown of screening, but a breakdown of low energy screening. Actually, at least I don't know how to justify something like a Hubbard model for such a system.
Comment on the red and green?
Here? No, that's a first order transition with the hysteresis. So that's a finite temperature first order transition which has hysteretic behavior. Sure, and it's supposed to be at finite temperature. It's certainly supposed to be first order, and we also have not a well established. Let me not go into that. So. Okay, now comes cold atoms with this enormous advance in just experimental techniques, and here you can really, as you all know, just realize the mod transition. So what you do is you take a standing wave of a laser, which gives you an effective potential, periodic potential for your atoms, and then if you put atoms in this lattice at sufficiently high laser intensities, the atoms really are described by a Hubbard model where they hop from side to side, and you really have only local interactions because these beasts are neutral atoms and they have essentially only contact interactions. So you get practically a perfect realization of the Hubbard model with one caveat, which is finally you have to hold the atomic cloud together, and that's usually done using a parabolic potential. So that's the main difference. So that's the 98 paper. That's the main difference for that.
They're now working on trying to make shared potential boxes, right?
Yeah, they are working on various. So essentially, if it's really important, then they will do also other things.
Yeah.
And people are working on doing other things. And so there's possibility to get around this.
Exactly.
I'll show that for the experiments I'll talk about, it helps a lot to have a parabolic potential. Otherwise, the experiment would not have worked. And you can do bosons, fermions, arbitrary mixtures. And so here, I think I should show the picture, which have you all seen before. So in 2002, the bosonic version of this thing was realized, and the mod transition for bosons was shown. And the main reason why I'm showing you this is to discuss what was actually done in this how was the mod transition detected in these experiments. And the answer is what was actually detected was so with bosons you have a transition from a super Bose condensation to a mod phase, and what was really detected is how the superfluid phase goes away. So the superfluid phase you can easily detect because it's a delta peak in momentum space, and so that they can detect easily in time of fly images. And when it goes away, you say it's a mod transition. That's how the mod transition is detected. But that's not so easy for fermions. Yeah, that was the first experiment. Yeah, you can measure different things. So you can measure upper Hubbard bands, for example, but they exist also on the you don't have to go in the mod phase to see this, for example. Yeah. So you see this also below half filling, for example, that there's an upper Hubbard band in the resonance, also experimentally. So the good. Now we switch from bosons to fermions, and I guess everybody in the audience agrees there's more fun there with fermions. So there are many phases: magnetism, superconductivity, and whatever dozens of phases we have been suggested for the high TC Coupe rates. And this really has the prospect really now to simulate materials, but there are two major problems. One is associated that it's still a serious problem of cooling. So cooling the fermions is still much more difficult than cooling the bosons. And as I mentioned, there's the problem of detection of what's really going on. And now in the last year, there have been two experiments, one by the Esslinger group at the ETH and one by the Bloch group, which kind of similar, and both showed, let's say, the onset of mod physics. And I'll mainly discuss the lower one because that's where we have been involved. But what is clear is, as there's no clear signature of the mod transition, you really need some theory to compare to experiments to be able to even to decide whether you have seen any mod physics or not. Okay, so what are we doing? We are doing dynamical mean field theory, which is, if you like, the simplest mean field style theory, which can capture the mod physics. And there are many ways to think about how dynamical mean field theory works. I think the most one way which I find most useful in this context is just to think that dynamical mean field theory is the approximation which says that the self-energy is local. So it does not depend on I and j, lattice indices I and j, but just it's a diagonal function. And then you see, from this formulation, you see also that you can also imply it immediately to inhomogeneous systems, so there is no homogeneity needed. And many people have done this. And what so this means when you have an inhomogeneous system, you map it now to many effective single impurity problems which are covered by some consistency equation. And we solve those by using numerical randomization group calculations.
Just a quick question. So I might worry that once the system is actually inhomogeneous, the approximation of neglecting the position dependence is maybe less credible than.
Okay. So let me first mention a few things. So first, it turns out that for the experimental system which I show you, actually whether you do it locally or globally, it doesn't matter. So for the experimental system I'm discussing, for experimental parameters, the approximation to say locally we have a homogeneous system is perfect. Actually, I've because of time constraints, I omitted all curves. I omitted all the discussion of the inhomogeneous solution. I'll show later only solution using this LDA approximation, so the approximation of approximating it by locally homogeneous system. So first, it doesn't matter whether it's homogeneous or not. Second, I don't think that it's really so the inhomogeneous solution contains all non-local single particle physics in a correct way, so you can get surface bound states. All this stuff is included, plus a strong inelastic scattering mechanism. So it is useful, and I don't think that it gets kind of worse. The third comment is DMFT is not a very good approximation. So what I'm claiming is it's just perfect for present status of experiments. I can comment later on that, but for the next sort of experiments, when you go towards magnetism and stuff like that, it will be quantitatively useless, but now it's working. So for the temperature regime present experiments are in, it's fine. If you like, the reason to justify the local approximation is that we had extremely high temperatures and strongly inelastic regime, and therefore the momentum dependence goes away. For example, in high temperature experiment, the leading term is a local term for the self-energy, to give you an example. So that's, it's justified really by being at very large temperatures and in a strongly inelastic regime. And I should mention that that's the one advantage of the dynamically mean field theory compared to all other non-stringy mean field theories. It has really dissipation in it. So most mean field theories doesn't have dissipation in it. This one does have dissipation in it without a black hole.
Can you do it with a black hole like a soft planet?
Yeah, well, that you know. So that I think is, for me, that's one of the most impressive things that of this ADS CMT correspondence, that there's really a large n limit which naturally has some dissipation in it. Which I find, that's what impressed me at least. I found that one of the more impressive facts. That you solve a classical equation of motion, that this has real dissipation in it.
So regarding that there is no other parameter, can't you see the disappearance of Fermi surface in time of flight measurements?
I'm not showing this. We checked it more or less like just calculating it. And in this trap configuration, at least, there's no real clear signature of that. I have the figure somewhere. I can show it to you later. The answer is you can't. There's not a clear signature of that. After you include the effect of the trap and everything. Okay, so I tried to shorten the clock to give more time, so I had to cut out a few things.
How low is the actual temperature? So the question is, how we're defining the primary surface? I understand that these experiments are done in the Atlantic.
Yeah, let me precisely discuss this question. That's more or less the only thing I want to discuss about this experiment, so then I'll switch to the next topic.
As far as time goes, you're getting questions now, so you should feel free.
I feel free, but nevertheless, try to move on. So how to detect mode transition? And so I think it's useful to think, and that's actually not what I was doing, but what Emmanuel is doing, is what is really at the heart of the mode physics. And at the heart of the mode physics is forming an incompressible state. So adding another electron is not possible because of the strong Hubble partition. That's really what mode physics is about. So if you want to detect mode physics, you should try to detect incompressibility. So remember, solid-state physics context, this is not going to work because the number of electrons per unit cell is fixed by chemistry. So you never change that in actual experiments, at least if you don't gate the system. But here, the idea is you should look for incompressible states, and you do this in the most naive way, namely you can measure just the radius of the cloud as a function of the confining potential. You start with a diluted cloud, and then you measure the radius of the cloud as a function of the strength of the parabolic potential, and first it's very diluted, so when you change the potential, increase the potential, the cloud gets smaller and smaller. But suddenly, here's shown the radius here, that's the radius from zero to some large values as a function, and here's the parabolic potential strength. So we start with a very smooth configuration with a large radius, and then we increase the strength of the parabolic potential, and at some point, in the center of the trap, a mod insulator starts to form because we reach filling one.
This is
DMFT in this local approximation, local density approximation. But we did the same calculation without using the local density approximation.
Just doing Hartree approximation, get something similar, I'm sure.
It depends on what you precisely mean by Hartree.
Yes,
so there are various versions of, so when you just do self-consistent Hartree, when you just do ordinary Hartree, you won't get that.
Yeah, because this is now.
When you do, you know this better than me.
Sorry,
for the sort of temperatures you're talking about, I don't know which ones, that's why I asked. Can't you just do quantum Monte Carlo, that's more reliable than
DMT? So you can do various things. So you can try to think about quantum Monte Carlo, which is fine at half filling. So at half filling, it's no problem to do it at this temperature. The problem is that you have all to simulate also the large, not half filling cases, and there you start to run into minus sign problems even at that temperatures. And you can also do a high temperature expansion. That Matthias Treuer did that, and that also is just. It's just breaking down in the experimental relevant regime. So it's just working. And
can you compare the experiments with each other, numerical techniques? Or rather, the numerical techniques.
Can we discuss this when we show the comparison of DMFT to the experiments, and then I can discuss the deviations. Let's go. So I was just describing. You reduce the radius, and finally the center of your trap becomes incompressible, and then the radius doesn't grow anymore. So it stops, and then until you reach a point where you start to fill up the second Hubble band in the center of the trap, and then the radius shrinks again until you reach the next incompressible state, which is the band insulator. Now, when you do this, the important part is to realize that this is not done at fixed temperature, but at fixed entropy. So the experiment is done adiabatically. Temperature is not so there's no temperature bath or something like that. So also the calculation done in fixed temperature, and that's shown here. So that's now this theoretical plot of these curves. And if you see the onset of this plateau here, that happens when you have an initial temperature of 0.15 Fermi energy. And when you translate this to an entropy, then you realize that the entropy, and that's actually turns out also the experimental condition, the entropy is log 4. So when I heard this for the first time, I was saying to Emmanuel, what does it mean? So having log 4 entropy in your system and you want to see mod physics. So mod physics, we know the entropy per particle is maximal log 2. So everything extra on entropy you have to create, you have to populate the upper Hauer band. So how can this happen? And the trick is that you can easily do this, or not easily, but you can just do it in an inhomogeneous system. So what is the idea? Well, the idea is we have a large entropy per particle, but we can dump a lot of entropy in the metallic belt around the mod insulating core. Yeah, so that's, for example...
Just for clarity, an experiment is like you load your trap up with particles, and then you cool it to a certain temperature, and then you adiabatically swing the trap.
Actually, you first cool it. So what you do is you first cool it without any potential, so without the laser switched on, and then you have essentially a non-detecting system, maybe even spinless fermions, so because there's only one hyperfine state. Then you can actually then at this stage you determine the temperature by doing a time of flight image and fitting to non-detecting fermions. And then you take this system and switch on everything else.
And that's then adiabatic.
Exactly, and that's supposed to be adiabatic.
And then temperature goes up when you...
And
optical track, right?
And then you check this, for example, you can start with your system, switch everything on, and switch everything off again, and then you compare how much heating has occurred.
Yeah, that's for example one thing. Apply the optical lattice.
Yeah, so there's one heating because you're not adiabatic, and there's another heating because there's a gas in the vacuum is not perfect. Yeah. Atoms pick from time to time, really pick up a photon from the lasers and stuff like that. So you have not infinite amount of time.
Estimate of the entropy in your discussion with Emmanuel, where did that come from?
That's the DMFT calculation.
Give you a temperature.
Exactly. That's the experimental temperature and determined from a free fermion fit to the thing before it's loaded in anything, and when you had spinless fermions. Okay, so that's, for example, so the red curves are the experimentally relevant ones, if you like. So that's the entropy per particle as a function of radius. Now, and you see in the center of the trap, it's indeed, the entropy is not log 4, but log 2, as it's suitable for mod transition. And the entropy per particle, that's really this thing here, that shoots up, because the guys far out have a large entropy. So the only reason why there was any mod physics signature was because the system was inhomogeneous. You had a parabolic potential which allowed you to trap, to get rid of the entropy in the tails of the system.
This local entropy is defined how?
So the local density approximation is very accurate. So locally you can describe the system by a homogeneous one.
The heat capacity of the metal is much larger than the...
Well, we are now at such high temperatures that so we were way, way above this first order transition, for example, between mod insulator and metal. So it's not...
It's like a classical gas.
Yeah, it's all... So the tails are at least a classical gas, and in the center you have the mod physics. Okay, so here comes the comparison of experiment and theory.
They are in a local,
we hope that the system is in a thermal equilibrium, that's the assumption, and I'll discuss this in a second. So the system has a fixed temperature which is now of the order of Benford at this stage. Good, so the experiment is done with 10 to the 5 potassium atoms in an optical lattice, and the initial temperature is this 0.15 Fermi energy approximately, which is this log 4 entropy mentioned. And this is, so cloud size is a function of the strength of the parabolic potential in the correct scaled coordinates. And so points are experiments and curves are theory. And the first thing I want to mention is that this is, to my knowledge, this is the first comparison of dynamical mean field theory to an experiment. So in the sense that no solid state system is really described by the Hauer model, this is really described by the Hauer model with local interactions, and all prefactors are known. So you know the strength, so there's no fitting, you know precisely what your hopping is, you know what your interaction strength is. And so there's zero fitting involved. You know all your parameters, and you just take it, solve it, fixed entropy. There's some numerical issues, certainly. Energy is not the best method at these high temperatures, but that's the strength of the laser field. Well, I would claim that in, no, because Hartree Fock, you would not get any reasonable value for the entropy. So this is strongly inelastic high temperature regime, and I'm sure that the Hartree Fock value for the entropy is completely wrong.
But you will not get nothing incompressible.
Pardon?
You will not get anything incompressible in Hartree Fock.
Yeah, we are anyhow at high temperature, so you could ask in what sense this is really, really incompressible.
Yeah, but you will have some tendency to incompressibility, you know, some depletion of your density of states or something like that.
I think that quantitatively would be wrong, and
single side atomic theory.
No, that's certainly okay. That was done. That comparison we did, and there you get completely different results. So essentially, this other experimental paper by the ETH group, they used the single side theory, and really got conflicting interpretations. Not me, but the experimentalists made this comparison and see what whether you get kind of similar results, and the answer was no. Good, and so. So present day, you see that you get a very good agreement, despite beside the region where it really gets interesting. So I showed you the real signature of mod physics is this flattening here going on, and you see there's something happening here. So that's these sweat curves. There's something going on here, but at the same time, that's the point here where you see. So here you see it's really you get the strongest deviation where there's where the things get most interesting, and so the question is whom to blame. So you can blame DMFT, you can blame the experimentalists, and we decided to blame the experimentalists and in the following sense. So first of all, Matthias Treuer did high temperature expansion, and as I said, it breaks down this regime, but his curves are closer to ours than to the experiment. So that suggests that the problem is not the DMFT approximation, which was not part of the high temperature expansion, but that the problem is really the experiments, and there's also a reason to expect that, and that will be the topic of the second talk, namely, for large U, there are long timescales induced in the problem, and it gets more and more difficult to become adiabatic. So claim is that the experiment is not fully adiabatic here, and unfortunately, you can't do the experiment much slower because of this residual heating going on in the system. So you can't do it five times slower, the experiment, to see what's going on. That's the topic of the second part of the talk.
Okay. Faster. Can be faster.
And then see if you get worse.
Yeah. Yes, that would be possible. Yeah, I agree with that. So, what is the present status now of using cold atoms as quantum simulators? So, presently one is just able to see the onset of mod physics. So you don't see it fully, but you just see the onset of mod physics. I think that one can see. And what is now obviously needed for this material simulation point is to have a more efficient cooling mechanism. For example, to see antiferromagnetism, you would need to reduce the entropy effect of 4 and let's say a factor 10 to get something like D-wave superconductivity. And there are certainly in the field there are many ideas how to do that. So I'm sure that in short time, one or the other groups will just find a nice way to add a second cooling stage when the fermions are trapped in the system to cool the system off and reduce some extra entropy. So I was thinking about a prediction for the higher TC conference. So I think it's pretty likely that so taking just the enormous so how good these experimentalists are taking this into account, I think it's very likely that within 2 or 3 years, then we'll have a detection of D-wave superconductivity in the 2D Howard model, in case that it existed in the way suggested by HITC. But on the other hand, that's the positive message. Negative messages, I think it's not likely that we'll get any real precision style measurements. One reason being a social one, which is so after they will have realized the D-wave superconductivity, they will lose interest in experimentalists and they will go on to the next hot subject. And while working this out in detail would need years and years of detailed studies, that's much tougher than just saying, oh, I have detected D-wave superfluidity in a 2D Hubbard model. So I don't think, so even something like TC as a function of doping is a very difficult experiment to do. So you have to find a way how to measure temperature in the system. There's a chance maybe getting entropy as a function in principle, this is all possible. Yeah? So it's not impossible to do it.
Using the metallic cloud, so to speak, as a thermometer.
Exactly. So there are many ways you can think doing this. You can use the metallic cloud as a thermometer. You can try to determine, measure the energy of the system. You can, you know it as a function of entropy and so on and so on. But I think, so you will not get the solid state precision type of experiments. As I said, the main reason is social one, not a sociology more than real reason. So if it's very important, then they will do it. But
I listened some time ago to Debbie Yin having a spectacular photoemission experiment in the cold atom class.
Yeah, so one of the promising, let's say one of the promising things which may go on is that they really will be able to do routinely local measurements of the atom cloud. So that's obviously useful for many things. And so several groups, I think, are working on the idea of doing real local measurements. And as soon as you can do real local measurements, so you look at one side in your optical lattice and measure spectral functions there, so kick out electrons and measure the energy distribution and do thermometry or whatever. So as soon as you have that, that would open again a new world of doing measurements. So I agree with that. So, but let me mention that independent of what precisely is going on, is I think one can use this stuff really as a test for theorists. And so that's the reason why many theoretical groups are now playing also these cold fermion atoms systems, doing their using numerical methods and developing this further to make really this quantitative comparison theory and experiment for models where all parameters are fixed and known. But so more fun is also to explore when you have this fascinating system with this enormous amount of control, also to do physics out of equilibrium. And so what can we think of? And there are many things we can certainly do. Let me start by saying, so usually when you have a high energy state in a strongly interacting system, it will just decay very rapidly. And the stronger the interaction, the more boring it gets in some sense. And there are exceptions, most notably there are topologically stable states which have difficulties. So if you have some order and you have a knot in your order, then this is a very stable thing. But there's also another exception, and that's when you have a system with band gaps, then there are just regions in energy where there are no single particle excitations, and that allows you to use energy conservation and not topology to give a long lifetime to highly excited states. So for example, take the Hubbard model at very strong U, so U 100 times bandwidth, let's say, and ask the question, what is the lifetime of a doubly occupied site in a sea of states with C or occupation C or 1? And then the problem for this, so this W occupied sites will just not decay because it doesn't know where to get rid of its energy. Yeah? So it has to dump the energy use somewhere. And if your bandwidth is 100, then it has to create 100 Pauli whole excitation. That's not easy with local interaction and Pauli principle and everything around. So from this argument, you expect that you get an exponentially large lifetime of this W occupied site. And that's actually that's also seen in experiments in more refined theories. So that's an early experiment in Innsbruck, where they just looked at a bosonic problem and showed that for strong repulsive interaction, you get so that's kind of without strong interaction, that's with strong interaction, the number of W occupied sites, and you get much, much longer lifetimes in this case. And a more precise quantitative experiment was recently done at the ETH. Group, and there you see, that's really a measurement of this lifetime of W occupied sites as a function of U over 6 times, so half the bandwidth, and you see here really this exponential increase of the lifetime, and at our conference, Eugene gave a talk about the theory, so his theory curves, I guess this dashed line, there's some uncertainty also in the theory, so which gives a very precise description of what's going on there. Good, so lifetime of W occupied sites is exponentially large, and you see you can easily reach values with moderate interactions where the lifetime is 100 times bandwidth, inverse bandwidth. So now the idea is to use that in a very simple setup. So the idea is you start with an atomic cloud which is tightly compressed, so you have a band insulator in the center. So you have essentially only W occupied sites in the center. And now the experiment is very simple. You do nothing but just slowly expanding the cloud. So you just reduce slowly the trap and the trapping potential. What does slowly mean? Well, slow means slow compared to the hopping and J and stuff like that. So now I was talking about the real J. exchange interactions, yeah. So you do it slow in terms of hopping rates, exchange interactions, but fast compared to this exponentially long lifetime. So what will happen? So W occupied sites, the number will be conserved. I said they don't decay on the time scale of the experiment, but they will get diluted, and now you may think, well, diluted bosons do Bose condensation. So there should be some sort of S-wave superconductivity, and that's in the model which is the worst enemy of S-wave superconductivity, which is the strongly repulsive Howard model. So what is the difference of something like that, so such a metastable superconductivity to an attractive one? And the main difference is if you have a pair, when it hops, it actually hops via a virtual low energy state and not a virtual high energy state. Yeah, and that gives a different sign of the effective hopping. And that means you don't condensate at momentum zero, but you condense at momentum pi pi pi. And that's good news because that's something the experimentalists can detect easily. So they can measure the momentum distribution of the pairs. And then when they see a peak at pi, then they would have just seen this sort of exotic superconductivity. Now, but that's not the end of the story, so one has to think a little bit more. Maybe there are other possibilities. So most importantly, instead of Bose condensation, the system could just phase separate, so the W occupied sites could glue together and never do any condensation. That's actually what happens with bosons. When you play the same trick with bosons, same arguments, there will be just phase separation, nothing going on.
So they do attract them, right?
Yeah, there's nearest neighbor attraction, so short hardcore repulsion and nearest neighbor attraction. That's both like true for bosons and fermions. Yeah.
It's like a super exchange type process.
Exactly. That's true both for fermions and both bosons, but for the bosons, the parameters are such that they phase separate. And now we have to decide what happens for fermions. And so we need a real control calculation. And usually this is not so easy in the strongly repulsive Howard models to do any control calculation. But here we are just lucky, and namely symmetry helps to get a controlled handle of that. And more precisely, we get a handle on the case when there are, when the initial state is such that they are only doubly occupied in empty states. And then that's what your Hamiltonian. You get that from Schrieffer-Wolf. And then you can rewrite this as a spin Hamiltonian, because for the zero and empty, so let's say spin down is an empty side, spin up is a doubly occupied side, and the whole thing maps to the ferromagnetic Heisenberg model. So two remarks are in order. So first, why? So and it's a uniform Heisenberg model. So you could ask first, why is it? Why is the rotation invariant? This effective Heisenberg model. And the answer is, the Hubbard model had a symmetry, the SU2 charge symmetry, that's now reflected in this property of the model.
And what we like effective U, except that the sign of the exchange interaction or the S idle dash J interaction has been flipped by. This effect that you go down instead of up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Are you at half filling?
No, I'm not at half filling. So there's an extra. So the trapping potential makes you an effective field in z direction. That's the full model, which may be on the next slide as a. But it's very important to have this SU2 charge symmetry, and that means at least for this thing here, we know the exact ground state. So, for example, all spins pointing up is a band insulator. All spins pointing down is a no particle state, and magnetization somewhere in the XY plane is then a superconductor. So you break the rotation symmetry on the z direction, and if you track the transformation back, which you made to go from here to here, and you see that what you get is a superconductor at momentum pi, and that's the famous eta pairing, which was known before to be a relevant operator in the Hubbard model, but which, well, so some of you may know the story of eta pairing, so that was fashionable some time ago, but then people realized that more or less has nothing to do with low energy physics of the Hubbard model. And here the message is just this eta pairing is very easily accessible in cold atoms experiments, and leads to a nice experimental verifiable scenario of exotic super fluidity.
Particle number,
fixed
speed. So wouldn't it be better then to make ferromagnetic in direction, but then all clumping all this
Exactly. So that's the question, and actually that's not the final answer, but that's the first answer to this question. So now we include the trapping potential, and that's an inhomogeneous system, and now you have to minimize that. And what you find, so outside there's no particle, so all spins pointing down, and then in the center of the trap is most favorable to break the symmetry and have the spins pointing somewhere in the XY plane instead of forming a domain wall, which would cost extra energy, and therefore you get in the center of the trap, you get the superfluidity. But that's not the end of the story, because we have to now think a little bit what we've really found. So do we really now have a, did we find a superfluid? And you realize we talk about a ferromagnet, and the ferromagnet and a superfluid are very different beasts. So ferromagnet has quadratic spectrum, superfluid has linear spectrum. That's fishy. Or the same, or other argument, which is what Daniel just said. So the energy difference between having a domain wall and having a superfluid, that's only surface energy. Yeah, so it's really tip. It's just at the balance between phase separation and superfluidity. And that means you have to be more careful. Namely, leading corrections can change the physics completely, because it's just balance between a phase-separated state, that's in magnetic language the domain wall, and the superfluid state. It's just balance in between. So you have to look for leading corrections.
But the model has a continuous symmetry. Do you remember we have a sharp domain wall?
Yeah, that's sure. Yeah. No. But. I agree, but what I'm saying is, what I mean, that a small perturbation now can. So I said that if you solve the real model, then you get something like that, which is your smooth domain wall, if you like, and that has a large superfluid fraction in the proper limit, so that's fine.
It's anisotropic, and it becomes some perturbation, which
exactly. And that you have now, as you would do in a magnet, you would also ask, what is? So we know spin orbit coupling is weak, but nevertheless, when it discuss the order space, we have to when we want to decide whether we have magnetization in Z direction or in XY plane, obviously without discussing weak spin orbit coupling is completely useless. In the same sense here, discussing the Hubbard model is not sufficient. We have to ask what are corrections to the Hubbard model. And as we know the system precisely, we precisely know prefactor, we know the sign and prefactor of the leading correction and what exists. And to make
I'm just slightly confused. Can you just hop back to your previous slide? Perhaps the slide before that.
Okay.
I think it talks. Right, so when you are in the middle, you feel a chemical potential, meaning that the spin system feels the net magnetic field, right? And it tilts the spins into the XY plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like an XY model, and it should have a linear dispersion.
The statement about the dispersion was a statement about the uniform phase.
That's clear, yeah.
So that's not true here, but here what I would insist here that there's a state very close in energy where just in the center of the trap all spins point down,
yeah.
And in the center of the traps all spins point up. So that's when this term is positive. All guys point in one direction, when it's negative, all terms point in the other direction. And the energy difference between the two is only a surface term. So when I add any bulk term coming from higher order correction to the Hubbard model, that bulk term can easily compensate this surface term.
Okay.
If you have 10 to the 5 atoms or something like that.
This is actually a bit orthogonal. I'm just worrying about if this is like a superfluid or like a ferromagnet, and I would think when you have this field applied, that just rotation in XY plane is like the relative physical motion. Because for the XY model,
yeah,
you don't
care sure.
about the sign of the exchange interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So when you manage to get it into the XY plane because you have this field, is it then a superfluid in the sense of linear dispersion?
So if you talk about, so again, in a trap, there's anyhow no quadratic dispersion. So when you talk about it, dispersion, we talk about a uniform system, yeah? And then we talk about uniform, and then you can, in a uniform system, you can just say, you work at fixed magnetization, yeah? And then you know for fixed magnetization, you have a Goldstone mode, which is quadratic dispersion. So that you would get,
What would happen here if you, conceptually rotated that and tried to get a vortex into the band? Do something, is that possible? Because then you've got to rotate in the plane.
Oh yeah, I haven't thought about that. So the vortex in this state. So there's, as I said, that thing doesn't, so I would expect that there are kind of many things can happen. I don't know.
Yeah.
So the two answers just I don't know.
Yeah, so it's somehow different from a normal superfluid.
Yeah, exactly. But
that's a little plumber version.
But now, as I said, we precisely know what the correct. So we now have to use corrections which break the SU2 charge symmetry of the Hubbard model. They exist. And we know their prefect and sign because we know what the bare model, what our high energy model is. And most importantly, there's, for example, a next nearest neighbor repulsion going on, and the sign of this is repulsion. So and that's clear that helps superfluidity, as you know. And there's also pair hopping, which is the same order magnitude in the other ones. For example, the next nearest neighbor hopping, that's formally would give you would favor phase separation, but it's in this limit we are considering that's small compared to the other ones. So messages. Physics is controlled by the corrections to the Hubbard model, and the dimensionless parameter characterizing this is given here. So this is this very weak perturbation of the Hubbard model, but it's multiplied by number of particles to the 2/3. That reflects that we are describing a fight between a bulk energy to a surface energy. So that's the dimensionless parameter, and that will be very large in the experiment. And that's, let's say, the condensate fraction you would get as a function of the strength of the parabolic trapping potential V. And you see that now, because we have this correction to the Hubbard model, we increase the condensate fraction, make the thing also more intrinsically stable. Okay, so
how did you calculate that?
That's mean fields now. So you do so what you get is now in this so to, in your Heisenberg model you have now an anisotropy, so which is easy plane style. So the correction have the sign that it's easy plane, then you do mean field for that. And that's justified because we are close to the ferromagnetic Hubbard model where the local uniform magnetization is the true ground state. So it's therefore it's a good approximation actually. So now So we said this metastable superconductivity is, in principle, it's easy to realize. You just expand a cloud, and it's easy to detect, so it has a clear signature. So you could ask, can it be done with present status cooling mechanism? And short answer is we don't know, because we can't have a reliable theory for the case when you have plenty of when you have many singly occupied states, then we can't have a reliable theory. But when you make a very crude estimates, then you can find out Bose condensation actually happens when the entropy per boson in a trap is below 3.6 kB. And that's, so this means per fermion, the entropy has to be below 1.8 kB, and that corresponds to temperatures 0.22, for initial temperature before loading the trap of 0.22 Fermi energy, and we are experimentally one is below that. So it's not even hopeless to see it with present day setup, but we don't have a reliable estimate for that. So exactly. What matters is not temperature, but entropy here. So it's high entropy superconductivity. Okay, so that.
What do you think? You have many single particle states?
Well, that's because of the high entropy. So the system has high entropy, and therefore, so you can't get rid of the single occupied states because of the high entropy of the presently prepared system. And we don't have any reliable don't have any calculation essentially which you would trust quantitatively. This know about two numbers. For this case. Okay, so let me conclude with this. So we now have the first experiments which really simulate the Hubble model for fermions, and we can, for example, do games like comparing to DMFT, and there are some onset of mod physics which you see in the experiments, and I'm sure there will be soon magnetism, and if it exists, then also D-wave superconductivity. And I think the future is certainly looking also for nice physics out of equilibrium. And I was giving a completely trivial example for that. It was not a true non-equilibrium effect, but it was really a metastable sort of superconductivity. But I think it shows the prospects that we can explore completely different regions, let's say, of our beloved Hubble model with simple experiments, but now in this non-equilibrium sector. And there are maybe even some higher temperature superconductivity in one way or the other. Lurking around. Okay, for that I want to thank you. Okay.
Nice job. I love your stuff.
But it's superfluid.
It's not charged, yeah.
And what about the quadratic spectrum? Is
really
superfluidity?
Well, with this correction, it gets linear.
Okay.
So the correction are such that it stiffens up. So I said, for example, there's near, so the hardcore bosons which you're talking about, they have a short range, so they're hardcore bosons, so they're repulsive on short range, but nearest neighbor attraction. And for the Hubble model, if they derive from the Hubble model, these two forces just compensate exactly in the low energy limit. So because of this SU2 charge symmetry, the repulsion attraction just compensates. And if I add now a little bit of next nearest neighbor repulsion beyond the Hubble model physics, then I tip it over to the more repulsive case rather than attractive case, and then I have then I get a proper phase stiffness.
I mean, is there an exact analogy? It's just sort of a matter of principle, right? The ferromagnet, as opposed to Einstein gas, have an exact order ground, right? In the sense that the ground state is an exact Einstein state of Hamiltonian. And then, in both cases, you add repulsions, and in both cases, you get the two superfluid in the sense of a Wilson boson, etc. Is that an exact analogy? The ferromagnet is precisely.
Well, you know that you may remember the story of the eta pairing. That was the original story. So that it's possible in a strongly repulsive Hubble model, using this SU2 charge symmetry, to create exact eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Yeah. So philosophically, we know already two exact eigenstates of the Hubble model, which is the empty state, no particle around, and the doubly occupied state, which is a band insulator. And now you can do SU2 rotations of these beasts, and that are also exact eigenstates. So these eta pairing states, so there are exact eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, which are eta pairing. That was the topic of these 89-90 somewhat papers on this eta pairing.
And that's, I could argue that because in the both Einstein gas and in the ferromagnet, you have exact ground states, you have automatically a K-square dispersion. And at the moment you add repulsive interactions, they have to get linear. But I just wonder if the and if it's just kind of an analogy, or that it can be sort of adiabatically continued in each other, because I guess in the ferrum, I think.
No. No. That's completely different variables. Yeah.
So it's a bearing has zero stiffness. Real leta bearing. I mean, if you don't have this extra term, it's not really superfluid.
Yeah, that's exactly.
So the superfluidity is proportional to this extra.
Well, as you know, there. Okay, so it's now depends on how you define. Yeah, I completely agree. So like non-intacting bosons, they are not superfluid. Mm-hmm. I would say, despite the fact that the condensate fraction is one. Yeah. So there's. It depends on how you define it precisely. But in any. Yeah, so period. So I guess we all agree that you need stiffness to have a true superfluid. And that would not be the case without these extra terms mm-hmm. in this model.
The obstacle is that when you wanted to start off with a band insulator, but then mm-hmm. you start off with something which has single occupancies.
Yeah. We cannot prepare the band insulator essentially. The experimentalist so that's actually one of the main cooling mechanisms. So one of the main cooling mechanisms is find a way to prepare a band insulator. Yeah, so you purge the system in such a way that only the darkly occupied sites remain, that they get denser and denser, and you find a way to remove the singly occupied sites by some process that would be a very, very efficient cooling mechanism, because the band insulator has zero entropy, and as soon as you have this band insulator as an initial state prepared, then you can do everything, and then you can do DMS2 conductivity and whatsoever. So find a way to purge the clouds that only doubly occupied sites remain, and that they kind of get closer and closer to each other. That's one of the main ideas for making an efficient cooling mechanism. And as soon as this is done, so if they find a clever way to get rid of the singly occupied sites, then you can play either this game or you can play all the other games also. But then by doing adiabatic change of your parameters, then go to the 2D Hubbard model at filling of 0.1 something, and see, and then try to find a way also to measure the E-wave pairing.
Just from the point of view of principle, I suppose, mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to this vortex issue. I mean, this is more analogous, this is a physical system that's more analogous to these small clusters that people calculate, where you can see superfluidity in the sense that your vector rotates down, but whether there's a phase transition there or not is really a separate question, because if you don't have the vortices there, then you can't really tell whether it costs a stylus or whatever else goes on and so on and so forth. So I'm not knocking, I'm just saying that in some sense, I'm not sure in what sense it says there's superfluidity.
So I completely agree that the most beautiful and maybe even the only experiments which really show superfluidity in any of these cold atom bosons or fermions problems is vortex experiments. Yeah? So that's really a thing which really proves to you that there's really phase stiffness. And so when you have quantized vortex vortices, then that's the real smoking gun. But you can also do other things like that has also been done. So how do you measure a pair? You can also measure the momentum distribution of pairs.
You could get at the phase stiffness mm-hmm. another way. I mean, I'm so superconductor oriented, but I think it would be equivalent. I mean, again, conceptually, if you were to take this track and oscillate it, then mm-hmm. you could measure the kinetic inductance, and that would give you the phase stiffness because you sort of induce a current going around. It might not be a whole vortex, mm-hmm. somehow detect that, then you measure.
I think the number of possibilities are kind of infinite. You can also just take a laser and whirl around in your superfluid and see what happens.
That would get at the phase stiffness question rather directly. And I mean, nobody, but nowadays the superfluid stiffness is more often measured by that kind of oscillatory experiment than it is by measuring penetration depth directly, because it's easier.
Mm-hmm. They've only 10 to the 4 atoms or something. Isn't that
well, in superconductor, that's what we do. We make sure
I know, but you have 10 to the 5 atoms and 3 electrons.
And here you come these metallic clouds, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But then, fair enough, but then you get into the question of what happens when you have these fermions around. Mm-hmm. No, you're right.
sort of basic level of confusion now. So, supposing we could do what you want to do. I start with just the band insulator. Mm-hmm. I expand. So now I end up with a pretty high energy state.
Yes, very high energy state.
Gazillions of other high energy states at more or less that energy. It's a many body system.
No. The claim is that. Let me be precise. The claim is that this exponentially large lifetime essentially says that the overlap of these beasts is exponentially small.
Separate issue. Is the claim that this is the highest energy state and therefore it's clearly not only one, but the
rational U.
This is a negative temperature. Is that
no, but let's discuss the simple case of a single ducting or crack site because it's the same question actually.
It isn't necessarily. So the point the question is the density of states for a many body system, right?
Yeah.
That rises exponentially with energy at least initially, and then it turns back over when you go temperatures go negative.
Yeah.
Are we at negative temperatures?
No.
If we're not, then I would think. So you know, for one impurity, okay, you've shown us the data, and so I'm just worrying in general grounds that I've got. Mm-hmm. If I've exponentially many states, how come that anything that I've missed out doesn't somehow couple to other things?
The problem is there are two factors, yeah. So two exponential factors which you're talking about, and one factor is the matrix element, and the other one is the density of states, yeah. And I think you would agree. Just imagine. So I think it's almost intuitive that the other factor wins because take this one doubly occupied site which has energy 100 times the bandwidth. Then we know this other many body states they must have 100 particle order excitations. So you have to have 100 particle order excitations to get rid of this energy 100 times bandwidth. So the state with the same energy has a completely different excitation spectrum, and as we have local interactions, there's no way how to get any decent overlap of the two wave functions.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm just worrying that as I go up, as I make it higher and higher energy, one of the exponentials is rising more rapidly than the other one, right? Which is the matrix element.
So if you don't,
I think the answer is very simple.
Well, that's the experiment is the answer.
But your question is a different one. The answer is extremely simple. I explain superconductivity in the class by, you know, first I explain negative Hubermann problem, right? And then I tell them, you know, let's go to the very top of the spectrum. I make a maximum number of W occupied sites, so I have basically n times U where n is my number of electrons with that rate. And now I switch the sign of U, and I get the ground state of the ground state sector of the attractive Hubermann model, and you know there that we have. This counting sector of all the doubly occupied sites, and the gap U, where these pairs build up, and there you have the exponential number of states start to build up. Right, so for the same reason that in an attractive U Hubbard model, you only have to worry about the single sector where pairs come around, Aachen can get away. Only worry about, you know, this macroeconomic sector where the same thing happens.
Let's make a switch.
I think that's the answer.
Okay, I'm happy. We can discuss this in